I've never been in trouble in my life. I didn't even have a parking ticket. I didn't, you know what I mean? I was brought up like cops are the good guys.
I didn't know what was going to happen, but I do know that everything was stacked against me. Everything, like everything.
This isn't supposed to happen this way. I'm innocent. I know I'm innocent. I know I had nothing to do with this. How is this possible?
I grew up trusting systems. I grew up believing that every human being should do the right thing. And that's why, even though I knew I was dealing with corrupt people, I wasn't going to bribe anyone to get me out of prison. Because I wouldn't live with the fact that I bribed my way out of my wife's death.
I'm not innocent until proven guilty. I'm guilty until I prove my innocence, and that's absolutely what happened to me.
Our system, since I've been out 10 years, it's come a little ways, but it's still broken.
I totally lost trust in humanity after what happened to me.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today we have an extraordinary event happening here in the studio because my friend Ndaba Mandela is here to talk about criminal justice reform. Ndaba, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jason. Appreciate it.
Ndaba, you are, I've not gotten to know you recently, you are a real throwback to your grandfather. I mean, everything I've gotten to interact with you has been, well, it's the closest I'm going to get to meeting the great man. And you were actually raised by him.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
So before we get into talking about criminal justice reform, which I know is a passion of yours.
Yes,
it's in
of
your
course.
Blood.
Yeah.
Can you just give us a little bit of the backstory? Because it's one of the most fascinating stories I know.
Yes. So basically, I like to describe myself as the second son of the second son of Nelson Mandela. I come from the first marriage of Nelson Mandela, which is he was married to Evelyn Marcy. A lot of people don't know that because they think his original wife was Winnie Mandela, but that was actually the second wife.
Right.
The first one is Evelyn, and then they had four children. The first one died at 6 months. The second one was my uncle, Tembekile. He passed away while my grandfather was still in jail. And then the third one was my father. So the first was a daughter, son, son, daughter. And my father gave birth to four boys, and I am the second son. And so when my grandfather came out of jail, he basically sent my parents to university because they never had the opportunity to go to university while he was away. And so when he sent them to university, he didn't want them to also worry about raising me at the same time. So he took me in when he sent my parents to university. I was about 11 years old
Wow.
at that time. And so I... You know, from the time I was 11 years old, I grew up with my grandfather. He raised me, basically.
A real witness to history. I mean, you had the front seat
Yep.
for one of the most important periods of time that ever took place anywhere in the world in terms of the impact it had on global change and civil rights and human rights and just everything. It's just a remarkable story in so many ways. And of course you visited him in prison, is that right?
Yes, I did. You know, the first time actually when I visited him in jail, you know, my parents told me that we're going to visit our grandfather in jail, and so I had a typical image of what jail was like. Concrete bars, wardens, you know, dogs, security everywhere. But when we got there, it was a house that looked much better than the house I lived in. Because I didn't understand that they had actually removed him from, you know, the Robben Island and put him in isolation. They were trying to break him down mentally to say, Madiba, you're an old man now. Denounce the movement of the liberation movement. Denounce your comrades. Denounce your party. And live the rest of your life in this luxury and enjoy your family and your grandkids. But of course, we know that that didn't work out, right? So when we got there, it was a beautiful house. There was a swimming pool. I never had a swimming pool, right? We watched The Neverending Story. There was a chef. We met the man, of course, and he was very warm and was so happy to meet every one of us. And so looking at that, I was like, wow, this is a beautiful house. You know, I would like to have a house like this one day. And so, you know, unlike most kids growing up thinking, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor, I said, when I grow up, I want to go to jail.
Wow. That's what an interesting thing. How old were you?
I was 10. No, 8 years old.
Yes, that's logical. At that age, that should be probably what the reaction would be for somebody coming from this circumstance and seeing this as it was. So it's interesting because I've been to his jail cell on Robben Island. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, obviously it's empty now, but I've taken mm-hmm. the tour, and it's a very profound experience to see what, you know, he and his comrades went through. And anyone who's, you know, even a casual student of the history, I recommend that they go when they get the chance, well, to South Africa for starters, but if you get a chance to visit Robben Island, it's not an experience that anyone will ever forget.
True.
He was locked up for almost 3 decades, right?
Yeah, 27 years.
And I'm interested in how that shaped your view and your priorities now, because, you know, you, well, probably of all the grandchildren, you were the closest to him, right? Because you were around him the most. He, from what I understand, he took a particular interest in you and saw in you a future leader, which, of course, especially at his age, he would have been very driven to ensure that there's, you know, a continuation of the movement that he built and of the progress that he made. Of course, it's forwards and backwards and one step and two steps and the whole thing, and even in America now, but... So how did his experience, from your perspective, shape him, and how did it shape you, and what are your views now on criminal justice reform in Africa, in the world?
You know, I think to a large extent, because he sacrificed his own family, you know, for the freedom of his country, you know, he sacrificed what he had here for the larger good of the society, it was a second chance for him to be a father, to play that fatherly role, you know, because he never had that opportunity. And so, you know, because he was a man that was a comrade, you know, was a soldier fighting against the system, you know, he made sure that he instilled certain values in me to become a leader. And, you know, one thing he said to me, which I'll never forget, is that, Ndaba, you are my grandson. Therefore, people will look at you as a leader. Therefore, you must get the best marks in class. And of course, at that time, I was just an adolescent. I was like, Granddad, whoa, that's too much pressure. I just want to get by. You know, I was a kid, much like my grandfather, a rebel, you know, sitting at the back of the class, very naughty, hardly did my homework, pea shooting, you know, the girls, you know, that kind of thing. But of course, as you grow up, you know, a lot of the time, you don't want to be treated as a special kid or the special someone. You just want to be a normal kid. And one of the things he also, you know, instilled with me was humility. It was very important to him. He said, Ndaba, you must never drive a Jaguar because people will know you have money. And as a leader, it's important that you are seen as one of the community, as part of the community. You understand? Even if you have more money than them or have more access to them, but when you are socializing, there must not be any sort of sense that you are more important or you should be treated in any other different way. So for me, it's the same thing when you talk about the criminal justice system or any sort of justice system, is how do we treat people with the same equality, right? Whether you're black, whether you're white, whether you're male or female, right? And the laws that we have, of course, stemming from apartheid segregation laws, similar to the Jim Crow laws, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about people who are trying to pretty much just live on an equal footing, right? That is really the struggle that they were fighting against. And that is the same struggle when you talk about the justice system, because the laws that apply to black people who are poor, who are marginalized, are not the same as the laws that apply to white people who have access, who are wealthy or well off.
That sounds a lot like America.
Right? You know, I was very inspired to be at the event last week in D.C. Mm-hmm. The criminal, the center.
Southern Center for Human Rights Dinner.
That's right. And it was the Frederick Douglass Awards ceremony, which, of course, we all know Frederick Douglass is one of the, you know, most powerful leaders, abolitionists, you know. And for me, it's really about making sure that people have, first of all, education to understand what their rights are, right? And be able, once you understand your rights, you'll be able to push, right? You know you have right for legal representation. You know you have the right to express what it is and not be afraid, so to speak, right? And that's really, for me, the importance of how do we make sure that we live in a society where everybody is treated the same regardless of your race or your sex.
Yeah, that's a dream that I think has been shared by all the great civil rights leaders. And I'm glad you brought up Frederick Douglass because I mean, it was 1847, right, when he started his abolitionist newspaper. And he, you know, the courage that he and the two, I forgot the names of the two people who started with him. One of them was a woman. But their lives were at risk every minute of every day as Mandela's was. Mm. And, there's a through line with all of this. I mean, it's so odd that we still have to have this conversation today, right? But we do. And it's probably more, more poignant at this moment than it would have been at almost any other time in recent history, speaking as an American, of course. But there are these parallels. And in America, everyone knows you have the right to an attorney. Is it the same thing in Africa? And one thing I tell to my listeners as often as I can is if you are arrested for something you didn't do or someone that you love is arrested for something you didn't do, all you're supposed to say, all you should say is, this is my name, this is my address, and I want a lawyer. Yeah. Because at that point, they have to stop interrogating you. Now, I don't know how it works in South Africa, but here, people... innocent people waive those rights because they don't think they have anything to hide. And they think, well, if I just cooperate, then I can go home. And they want to be helpful generally, right? People want to help the police. They want to be good citizens. Yeah. They want to be...
innocent people, yes.
Yes, it's a paradox.
Yeah.
But how does it work in South Africa? I mean, ironically, I think we have a much higher incarceration rate than you do now, especially for people of color. But in South Africa, is it a similar system? Are you entitled to an attorney? And if so, when and how does it?
Yes, you are entitled to an attorney. If you can afford one, the state will provide one for you, right?
Right.
Same thing. But of course, in a lot of the time, the view, right, the general view is that it's better to have money to pay an attorney because once you're able to pay an attorney, he does a better job. Right?
Generally speaking.
That is the general view that people have. But what I've seen actually is that because, you know, my own brother was involved in a criminal case. He was accused wrongfully of raping a young girl who was under the age, right? And, you know, it was a very, you can imagine, rape is a very sensitive case, right? And my brother was acquitted because obviously he did not commit the rape. So it was some sort of a witch hunt that we didn't really understand where it came from. But that said, yes, everybody's afforded a lawyer. Otherwise, you go with the state lawyer.
I have so many questions about how the system works in South Africa. One of them is the death penalty. Everyone knows that I'm a strong advocate of abolishing the death penalty. I don't think it serves any, it doesn't serve any useful purpose. It's been proven in every study. It doesn't deter one crime from happening ever, ever, ever.
Yeah.
And it is barbaric and it is arbitrary and capricious. And, you know, everything about it is wrong. It's expensive, even if that's where you're coming from. It's, it's imperfect. Even in a perfect system, it would be imperfect, right?
It's inhumane.
It's inhumane, but also, you know, the conversation I have with people who are pro-death penalty, I say to them, and I had this conversation recently, I was giving a talk at the New School, and one guy came up afterwards and he said, well, I'm in favor of the death penalty. And I said, okay, how many innocent people is it okay to execute? What percentage? And he says, no, you can't execute innocent. I said, okay, but then you're talking out of both sides of your mouth.
Exactly.
Because we know the system isn't perfect. You know the system's imperfect. Even if everyone is an honest actor in the system and doing the best job that they can, and everything is moving through the way it's supposed to, which it doesn't,
yeah,
and it can't, and it never will. We can make it better, but we'll never make it perfect. You're still going to execute a certain percentage of innocent people. So that's where it all breaks down. It should break down for 100%. Everyone. But do you still have the death penalty in South Africa?
No. One of the first things that our government did, the ANC-led government, was to abolish the death penalty. Because we come from a system that was using violence as a means to govern. You understand? So we had to make sure that we break the cycle of violence, you know? Killing someone because someone killed somebody is not gonna, like you just said, it's not gonna take us anywhere. You're just gonna continue perpetuating the cycle of violence. So where does it end? You understand what I'm saying? So that was a very key thing that we did in our country, was to abolish the death penalty completely, 100%.
And what about sentencing laws in South Africa? Because here, as you know, we have some of the harshest sentencing policies in the world.
Yeah.
And it always boggles my mind, like why and how we got to this place. I understand it intellectually, but I don't understand it on any other level. On a humanitarian level, it's insane. I mean, we've just had a case actually this week where a gentleman in Tennessee had been convicted of his first-time offense. He was selling, I think, a small quantity of drugs from inside of his own home.
Mm-hmm.
Two adults, right? There was no violence, no threat of violence, nothing else, right? Mm-hmm. But it turned out he was in a school zone, right?
Uh-huh.
But he was inside of his own house.
Not selling to children or
no,
students.
No, nothing like that. And he was sentenced to 17 years in prison. So he...
Jesus.
Yeah, so he was just freed this week, actually with the cooperation of the prosecutor, which is such a nice thing to see. We don't see it often enough.
Yeah.
But he still served 10 years in prison. I mean, we're so out of step. That's like murder, right? He was treated as a murderer.
That's insane.
And so how do you deal with that in South Africa? What about the drug laws? Is it do you treat it the same way that we do, so harshly?
I don't think they treat it so harshly. In South Africa, of course, I think, which was the same here, would be the mitigating factors as to how you put the sentencing. You know, is the person remorseful? Do they understand the detrimental effect that they have on society? And what are the mitigating factors? You know, you can't just say, oh, you were selling cocaine, therefore you automatically get 15 years. Was he a first-time offender, second-time offender, third-time offender? So you have to really look at all the different mitigating factors to actually come up with the right sentencing. And in South Africa, I would say it's pretty fair because, you know, looking at, you know, when we achieved independence in 1994, there were, even before 1994, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right, where we basically gave amnesty to perpetrators of violence against the victims if they were coming onto the table to disclose everything that had happened. So if you come up and you say exactly what happened, be very honest, who were you with, what made you do it, etc., and you would be literally sitting in front of the victims of those people that you perpetrated against, they would give you amnesty. So for us, I think personally that the system in South Africa currently is not as harsh as that of America. For example, you know, we met a gentleman last week at the event. I forgot his name now. But that gentleman, you know, what struck me was that he received 23 years, which is the equivalent of two life sentences, for stealing goods of $550, a first-time offender, a man with a college degree.
And a Navy veteran as well.
A Navy veteran. That would never happen in South Africa.
Right.
That would not happen in South Africa. That is absurd. That is insane.
Yes. And so we were talking about Lenny Singleton, who was convicted of a series of what we call dash and grab robberies, right, where he went in And he pretended, he had his finger in his pocket, he pretended to have a weapon, right? So technically that's considered armed robbery in America. But he never hurt anybody, never touched anybody. He just grabbed the money from the cash register.
And he didn't have a weapon.
He didn't have a weapon, yeah.
Although he pretended to have it, but he didn't have one.
He didn't have a weapon, yeah. No. Nobody argued that point. And he confessed. You know, so he was, so in your view, you know, in your system, this would, anyway, it's so crazy. And here with drugs, it's absolute madness because, you know, years ago I did a presentation for the Democratic Policy Committee in the United States Senate, and I brought with me, one of the people I brought with me was Federal Judge Castillo, who is the chairman, vice chairman of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And he talked about how he was given this most profound responsibility, which is to sentence another human being to prison. And then the Congress took all that power away from him because they established these mandatory sentencing laws, which we have here now, so that if someone gets picked up with drugs, they just look at a chart, here's how much drugs it was, here's the thing, blah, blah, and then you get that much time and the judge has no power to judge. The jury says guilty and off you go according to the chart.
Yeah.
But in almost all other types of crimes, when there's no mandatory sentence involved, they look at the other factors as they do in South Africa, right? Yep. And they say, well, your childhood was this, or you were or you're disabled in such way, or you have an experience of this, or you're positive, contribute positively to society in certain ways. And those things are mitigating factors and go into the sentence, you know, that the judge then decides on. So judges, of course, hate these mandatory sentencing laws because they can't do their jobs.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, I've been on the board of Families Against Mandatory Minimums for 25 years now, famm.org. I hope people will go and look because they're doing the most important work in eliminating these crazy sentencing, draconian sentencing policies that send people to prison for these horrendous amounts of time for nonviolent first offenses. It's just nuts. And I don't know why we do that to our own citizens.
Yeah.
Every one of these people is a child of someone, a brother, a sister, a mother. It's like you're ripping these communities apart. And of course, it affects people of color disproportionately. That goes without saying.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that's probably still true in South Africa even to this day, no?
Well, of course. I mean, the dynamics are a little bit different because in South Africa, 87% of the population is black, are the natives, as they used to call us, and 13% are the white people. One thing that I always wonder about is that, you know, in South Africa, being a cop is not such a beneficial job as I see in America, right? I see in America that the cops are very well looked after by the system, but in South Africa, it's very easy to bribe a cop. It's very easy to bribe a cop. You don't have to have a lot of money. You can literally bribe a cop with equivalent of $10, you know, to get away with drinking under the influence, for example. You know, that's how easy it is, and that's generally the thing across the continent of Africa. But I don't see that happening here in America. I see the cops really, you know, being hardcore. I think my perception anyway, to bribe a cop for DUI, you'd have to pay him like $1,000 or $5,000, something like that, right?
And of course, it's another crime if you try to bribe a law enforcement official. They can add to the charges, you know, if they, you know. And so, and here, I think you're right, it doesn't happen often. And I'm one of these people who I say, you know, that I believe in a system of laws. I want to make it better. I want to make it fairer. But I recognize that most of the people in the system are people who mean to do well. They took these jobs because they wanted to protect society. You know, that holds true for the judges and many of the prosecutors as well. There are some bad ones, though. And the bad ones, if you have the misfortune to run across one of those, your life can be turned upside down in an instant. And we know too many of those stories. And it's really, well, Lenny Singleton was one.
Hmm.
And of course, you met John Huffington when you were there as well,
yes,
who's been on the show, so sort of 32 years on death row for
crazy
murders, two murders that they knew he didn't commit. And, you know, he's an amazing, amazing guy. He had that great saying, right, when we were talking to him and somebody said, "Aren't you bitter?" And he says, "No, man," he goes, "That's why the rearview mirror is small and the windshield is big." And I was like, oh, man.
I love that saying. Yeah.
He must have read some of your grandpa's books, I guess, or something, because, you know, that's channeling that spirit, right?
That's true.
So if you could wave a magic wand, and, you know, obviously there's so much going on in South Africa beyond the criminal justice system. You know, we're here with the guys from BETPAW, who is an organization that's devoted to trying to save the rhinos and the elephants, because, you know, you're facing an existential crisis there with the possible extinction within a decade of the most iconic animals in the world. And what that will mean there's so many terrible consequences of that, right? I mean, it hurts my heart, but also with tourism and everything else. So there's a lot of issues that you're dealing with, and I know you're very active in the affairs of the country, and you love your country. I'm looking forward to visiting you over there.
I look forward to hosting you, brother.
Uh-huh. And but if you could wave a magic wand at the criminal justice system and make it, you know, remake it in a way that was more consistent with your own values, vision, if it was, you know, again, drawing from the lessons of, you know, your grandfather, the great hero, what would it look like and what would you do? Because maybe you'll have the opportunity. I hope so.
You know, they are, for me, what I've learned is that, you know, people will commit crime. There are two reasons why people commit crime. One is poverty. Two is purely criminal element, right? Trying to crook the system. So as much as you want to deal with the criminal justice system, you have to look at the factors why people commit crimes, right? It's poverty. And then you have gangsterism, which is just pure criminal element. So for me, a large part of that is the poverty. You know, if you were able, my wand would be to make sure that people have education, would get rid of poverty. Because once you get rid of poverty and people have education, half the people who are in jail will not be in jail, if not more. If not more. So let us deal with the fundamental issue at hand. That is the fundamental issue at hand for me. That's where I would wave my wand.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Yeah, I mean, that's addressing it at the cause, right? As opposed to the effect. And I think we have to deal with, I call it prevention and cure. I mean, we have to deal with these problems on every level. Ironically, it is a cycle, right? Because we know that in America, the sociologists that have studied this issue have come to the conclusion, which is probably not a shock, that the number one determining factor of whether a child will end up in prison eventually is whether they've had a parent in prison. And so we have to break that cycle, and we have to attack it on both fronts. We have to reverse mass incarceration and let these people out who are not any threat to society. Mm. We have to reform the bail system. I'm curious to know how that works in South Africa as well. That's the next thing I want to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. And we have to get rid of these mandatory sentencing laws that lock these people up for these insane periods of time. You know, the great Brian Stevenson. Have you met Brian?
No.
You'll have the privilege at some point, and he'll have the privilege of meeting you, I hope. So Brian Stevenson is a great hero of mine, and he has a wonderful expression where he says, "I believe everyone is better than the worst thing they've ever done." And
it's true.
I think
I believe that.
Yeah, we have to start looking at these people as people and not numbers and not statistics and not inmates and not, you know, I mean, it's the new Jim Crow, right? It's the modern version of slavery. And, you know, I don't know if you know this, but in America, when slavery was abolished, it was only abolished for free people. So they never changed that. So it's still legal if you're in custody of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an economic engine.
Yes, right? Machine. That's right.
Right, which feeds the rich people. Yep. At the expense of the poor.
Yep.
And then we end up in this vicious cycle, like I said, which takes us right back to, you know, the impact that it has on the families and the communities of these people who are, again, mostly people of color, who are being taken away from that because of transgressions that they're and I consider myself one of the lucky ones, because I grew up in an upper middle class environment where I was not subjected to the same type of treatment. So, so what about, that's one topic I do want to cover, is bail. How does it work in South Africa? Because here we have a crazy system where if you're arrested and you're charged with shoplifting or jumping a turnstile or drinking a beer in public, whatever it might be, bail might be set at $250 or $1,000 or whatever it is, a small amount. But if you don't have that money, you're just staying in jail until your trial.
Yeah.
That could be weeks or months or even years.
That's true.
And what we should be doing, of course, is sending people home to their family, to their job, to their church, whatever they're doing, and then come back, and here's your date to come back, and we'll see you in court, and then we figure this out, and that's it. But yeah, that's not the way it works here. We have almost 500,000 people in jail in America while we're sitting here just because they're too poor to post their own bail.
Hmm.
So we have two separate systems of justice here, one if you're rich and one if you're poor.
Yeah.
That's a violation of the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, but we're not going to get into that now. This is not a constitutional law class. However, how does it work in South Africa? Do you have a similar arrangement there?
It's pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same. But in my experience and my knowledge, bail is never really set that high. Generally, people can afford bail. But of course, you do have poor people who cannot afford it. And it's terrible because now you're in jail. You know, you get fired from your job. So you don't even have a means to pay for that bail. You know, if you're able to continue your job, you know, because it should be innocent until proven guilty. But the minute you are accused, for example, of rape, most people automatically assume that you are guilty. You know, and I have a personal experience of this because my younger brother was actually accused of rape. Now, the minute you are accused of rape, and we know this, it's one of the most sensitive crimes there is. The minute you're accused of rape, most people automatically assume that you're guilty or will side with the female without knowing any, you know, information about how it took place, where it took place, any information whatsoever. Just because you are accused of rape, he must be guilty. Why would the woman accuse him, you know, out of nowhere for rape, you know? But they don't even know what the situation, they don't even know the relationship of these people. Right? And that's one of the worst sort of crimes out there, right? To be honest. It's one of the worst. So, yeah, bail is pretty much works the same.
Right. And here, it's supposed to be set according to your ability to pay. But it's not done in that manner, typically here. It's just sort of done almost by, it's almost like it's done by a machine. It's just sort of, here's the thing, they just draw a line, you're accused of shoplifting, it's going to be $500.
Yeah,
because there's too many people going through the system, it's overloaded, and so they just, some of them you don't ever see a lawyer, you don't get any, you may even be doing it on a video screen, they may do it in a group. People aren't aware of this until they get caught in it, but man, once you get caught in it, it just gets worse and worse, and it's exactly as you described, because then your life gets significantly worse, because most of these people, if they can't afford bail, it's because they're living paycheck to paycheck.
Exactly.
And now your job is going away, your apartment, you're going to lose that if you have one.
Yeah.
You could lose custody of your kids. It's just a terrible, terrible downward spiral that you get into,
yeah.
And only because you're poor. And that doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever. And it's another one of these things. If I had a magic wand, that would be one of the first things that I would fix. That and our system of parole and probation and all this other stuff. How about the jail conditions? Because it's such an odd thing, you know, now we have groups of people going from the United States to visit prisons in Western Europe.
Okay.
In some of the countries in Western Europe, like Germany, the prisons are designed for the purpose of rehabilitation, mm-hmm. and their prisoners are treated humanely, they're treated with respect. The same is true in Scandinavia, where they're treated, you know, in a way where it's basically a philosophy of, hey, you guys are going to come out one day. You're going to be my next door neighbors. That's how the guards approach it. The guards have to study for 2 years. They have to get degrees in psychology. It's amazing, right? And as a result, those countries have much lower recidivism rates than we do. Mm-hmm. They're allowed out for furloughs and things like that to go work. And even before they're released, they go out to look for jobs and things like that.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, so the good news is we now have delegations from our corrections system institutions, some political leaders going and visiting and seeing how it can be done. There's some movement. We have a long way to go. But basically, our system here is designed for punishment, not rehabilitation. And some of the conditions in the jails and prisons are absolutely brutal.
Same in South Africa. I mean, you used to be able to get a degree in jail. You can't anymore. That has been taken away completely. There's so much overcrowding in cells. You know, you get a room like we're in right now with easily 20 people living in a cell like this. I mean, I don't know about here, but the amount of rape that occurs inside the prison is heavy. You know, there's gangs obviously in prison, and there's one of the gangs in South Africa that actually specialize in violence and systematically, you know, raping and instilling fear in other prisoners. There's also the amount of corruption because of poverty. You know, prisoners are able to bribe the wardens to the point where if a adolescent, right, juvenile, you can pay the warden to say, hey, I want that young boy to come into my cell tonight. And they can have his way, have his way. I'll tell you about I studied criminology. And there was a gentleman, I forget his name though, but he had such a crazy story. He was actually a general, right, in the prison. So he was one of the most ruthless, feared persons. He even had a way of how to attack and kill somebody that he had to kill. You know, he used a pen, he'd sharpen a pen, he'd go for the neck, go for the eye, you know. But one day, he said, when everything switched for him, is that when he witnessed a young boy, hardly 16 years old, got gang raped by about 10 guys and was on the floor bleeding, crying, just completely in shambles. And he saw this kid and he said to the kid, do something for yourself. And the kid said, I can't see, I can't feel, what can I do? And that touched him so deeply that he actually decided that he's going to change from becoming a general and actually expose the corruption that was happening in jail. And so he spoke to people outside the jail. He smuggled in cameras into the jail, right? And exposed the rape, exposed the criminal activities that the wardens were actually getting involved in, to the point where he even got a pardon from the president of our country. And he ended up marrying his lawyer, which was a white woman, and he was a black guy, because of what he had witnessed of this sort of gang rape of this young boy that had come into the cells, you know. So the conditions are horrific. The conditions are disturbing, to be honest with you. When I visited my, you know, like in jail, cigarettes are a currency. Cigarettes are a currency. People smuggle in anything and everything, as you can imagine, right? But more so, it's the corruption of the actual system, because the wardens themselves are part of that corruption system that has been entrenched over decades. You understand? Over decades. So basically, with money, you can do anything you want to do. If you have money, you can live like you are living in a normal apartment in Midtown Manhattan, pretty much.
And if you don't, you're living in hell.
Yeah.
Literal hell. Yeah. I mean, the way you described it can't be much worse than that. That's it. Yeah. And in fact, we had an amazing guy, a hero of mine, Pete Uko, from Kenya, was on the show, and he had been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death. And he was describing a similar situation to what you said, where he was in a small cell with 13 other guys. And he said that in order for them to sleep, they would all have to lay on one side facing the same way, and like sardines in a can, they would have to roll over at the same time. And, you know, it's just,
oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy. And his story is amazing. I'll show you the podcast that Pete Uko is on, and now he's on the verge of becoming a lawyer, and he's just joined one of the boards of Amnesty. I mean, he's doing amazing, amazing things, and helping the youth over there. What a great guy. Hmm. So anyway, we have a tradition here on Wrongful Conviction, which I'm going to share with you now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually my favorite part of the show.
Okay.
Probably a lot of people in the audience would agree. But anyway, this is the part of the show where our honored guest gets the free reign of the microphone. What I do is I give you my thanks and thank the audience and our producers as well for being here and sharing your thoughts and your wisdom. And thank everyone for listening. And now for the last part of the show, I'd just like to turn it over to you for any closing thoughts you have on anything at all.
You know, what I can say in the words of Nelson Mandela, education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change your world. And that's why it's important for us to make sure that young people have access to information, have access to education, so that they can understand that they are the masters of their destiny. We need to make sure that we empower as many young people as we can. We need to become mentors in our society. Gone are the days where your judges, your lawyers, your doctors are the most influential people in society. These days, it's your musicians. It is your actors, your entertainers who are the most influential people on the young people, right? And those people are not always cognizant of the influence and the sort of role model position that they hold in society. And so they don't actually take it to consideration, right? And they may be careless with it. So I would like to say that each and every single one of us has the opportunity to mentor a young person, to make sure that young person can deal with whatever challenges that they face, even if it is just helping that young person with doing their homework, finding out how their day was, finding out how their week was, what you can help them with. You know, there are so many young people out there whose parents are in jail, who grew up without a father, without a mother, you know, who don't value themselves in society, and they become easy prey to gangsterism and being recruited by the thugs in society. So I want to say to the people out there that, you know, if you take just 1 hour a week to sit with a young person, to mentor a young person, and you do that 1 hour a week, that is nothing. On a Saturday or a Sunday to sit with a young person, to mentor that person, think about the positive effect and the value that that young person will have to know that there's somebody out there who cares for them, who will spend the time, because time is just as important as money, to be with that person, to listen to them, to give them guidance. For me, we all need to go out there and try to be good mentors in society. One young person, that is all it takes, 1 hour a week. You can make a much better society.
Thank you again for being here on Wrongful Conviction. I look forward to working together to make a difference, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yes, sir.
So this has been an extraordinary experience for me, and thank you again to our audience for listening.
Thank you very much, Jason. That was beautiful.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help. And you know, I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again. I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I hope you'll join me in supporting this critically important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org. That's www.innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I also want to thank the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law for providing us research on these cases. And I want to thank our producers and editors, Juan Torres Falcon and Jenna Ruggiero. The music on the show, as always, is by the one and only Jay Ralph. Engineering by Cesar Haliwa. Don't forget to check out our website, wrongfulconvictionpodcast.com. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava Media, LLC, and Revolver Podcasts.